often does self-doubt get in your way? If you're like most people, it's more often than you think. Self-doubt creeps up on us in big and small ways that keep us from leaving our comfort zones, even when those comfort zones are making us miserable. This week, I talk with Amy Bernstein, author of the upcoming book, Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration. Amy shares her own story of pivoting from a career in government to a full-time writer and the steps she took to make that transition. She also encourages us to have an honest reckoning with ourselves and offers great practical advice on how to reconnect with our joys and passions so that we can find more meaning and purpose in our lives. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. Welcome to the Imposter Syndrome Files. My name is Kim Menninger, and as an executive coach and former high-tech leader, my personal mission is to help professionals overcome imposter syndrome so that you can advance your career with confidence. Each week, I interview a new guest who brings a powerful perspective to this conversation, including personal stories, best practices, and new insights. The more we talk about this issue, the more we destigmatize imposter syndrome, recognize that we're not alone, and empower ourselves to access the tools and resources that can help us and those around us. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing with others you think would benefit from this conversation. Welcome, Amy. I'm really excited to talk to you today, and I'd love to start by inviting you to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Kim. I'm really happy to be here with you today. So I wear many different hats, I guess, over many different years. I come out of a sort of a government, quasi-corporate, nonprofit working background over many, many years. But I made a pivot, really, in middle age to become a full-time writer. And I'm also a book coach. So I write my own fiction and nonfiction, but I really help other authors on their path to publishing as well, and teach a number of writing courses. So I cover a pretty broad gamut there.
And so I want to actually talk about the pivot, because that tends to be a moment of self-doubt for a lot of people. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what was happening for you as you decided to make that change, and what stimulated it, and what kind of feelings did it bring up for you? How did you navigate that?
Absolutely. I think it is so important for people heading into their 40s and 50s to recognize that who you are now in that moment is not necessarily who you will be forever, and that we all have the capacity to make significant changes that help us become even more the people that we want to be. We don't need to stay there. It takes a lot of courage and internal commitment to make those changes, but I can tell you from the other side, it's really rewarding. So let me tell you quickly kind of what my own path was through that. Mm-hmm. I was working for the federal government in Washington, D.C., in an extremely high-stress job with very long days. You know, I didn't see the sunlight on either end of the day. There was a lot of pressure to do a tremendous amount of work under a lot of scrutiny. And, you know, I was doing really well, and I was really unhappy. I just felt that I was working so hard for other people and not working hard enough for myself. So I made a decision over time that I didn't want my life to continue on that path. I didn't want to be unhappy every day. And I determined that my passion had always been to try to write more, because I'd always been in the communications and writing field anyway, that I wanted to take charge of that. So I wasn't doing that work for other people. And I basically, with my husband's support, and it really is important to feel supported on this journey, with my husband's support, I made a series of step changes, which is to say I didn't make this change all at once. I began writing fiction in my free time. I started with playwriting to see how that felt. I wrote a novel commuting on the train, mostly to and from D.C., because I really wanted to do that and to see how that felt. So I was trying to step into my creative passion for really unplugging from, you know, the world that I was in. And then I started a series of job changes where I could pull back on the intensity, cut down on my commute. So I did this gradually over time. And a day arrived within a couple of years, and the pandemic really helped this, actually. by the time the pandemic hit, I was actually working part-time. And this had taken, you know, about 5 years to go down this road, right? I was writing more. I was working less. Didn't happen all at once. I was feeling better. And I turned to my husband one day and I said, you know, it's a question of when, not if. Meaning I was going to pull out from what I call the formal wage world to do my own thing and probably never go back. And that was a huge, huge step because our work identities are such a big part of who we are. And when we don't have that anymore, who are we? And believe me, I went through days when I did this, what have I done? This was a mistake. I'm never going to do anything meaningful again. I'm invisible. I can't earn any money. I really panicked, even though I thought I'd prepared myself. Well, that's all by way of saying, you know, fast forward, here we are in 2024. I am so creatively challenged, fulfilled, sort of jazzed up to do the work that I do now with book coaching, with my own writing, with my own books. I'm plugged into a writer's community around the world. I'm in a much better place, you know, mentally, in a sense, physically, because I don't have those same types of stress on me. And just feeling that I'm heading into my later years with passion and purpose. So I really recommend this. And what I say to everybody is, come on in. The water's fine. You can plan a path to step into your passion.
I love that so much. There's so much about what you said that really resonates with me. And I love the step changes that you describe, mm-hmm. because I do think that as humans, we tend to think in all or nothing terms.
Right.
It feels like I have to abandon my financial security and, you know, make this flip of the switch kind of a decision that feels incredibly scary for so many reasons to then transition into this other world. And so the fact that you did this in this very gradual way, I think it can give hope to people who can't see how they get from point A to point B.
That you are so right. And, you know, I don't know that I planned it so cleverly is that it's the way it had to happen. Looking back, I do think that scheduling off ramps for yourself in sort of a cascade series makes all the difference. And so, you know, that first logical step might be, can you find a job that, you know, while still meeting your financial goals, or at least most of them, perhaps gives you more breathing room. Take a step back from that all-consuming work, whether it's a combination of your work hours and your commute and the fact that you're on call 24/7. If you can start with a step back from that and make some space for yourself sort of inside, then you can begin to give yourself time to think about, where do I really want to go? What really lights me up inside? You know, what would I do if I really could take back more of my own sort of time and both emotional and intellectual energy? And so you need to create that breathing room as you begin to sort of step into these transitions. And I think that combination can be very powerful. And I also encourage people, when they begin to make that time, find a course or a class or a workshop to experiment with something you feel drawn to that you wouldn't have done any otherwise. I mean, it might be a cooking class. It might be a sculpting class. It might be a clayworks class, whatever it is. And maybe it's a writing class. Step into that, because there's no downside for you to do that. You may realize, oh my gosh, I feel like a different person when I'm sitting with the pottery wheel, like a different human being. And that's the human being I want to feel more like. You may make that discovery, but you need to give yourself the time and the permission to do that. And it's really worth, you owe yourself that, because you have a whole, you know, second half of your life to lead, and why not find a way to lead it in ways that are fulfilling?
One thing I love about what you just said, the idea of taking a class that interests you, is one of the things I talk about a lot is how high achievers in particular tend to curate their worlds in such a way that we only do the things that we're guaranteed to do well, even if they're things that don't make us happy, right? We kind of create these very small worlds for ourselves because we're so afraid of failure. We have often perfectionist tendencies. And so what you're describing in terms of taking a class has so many layers of benefits, because A, it might introduce you to or reinforce a passion that's been dormant for a while because you haven't been giving it time, but also it reminds you that it's safe to be a beginner again. It's safe to learn and not be perfect at something. And then I love what you're saying too about it gives you a chance to experience yourself in a different domain. Like you said early on, I was doing really well, but I was unhappy. And I think that is an experience that so many people have, and they don't understand how to break out of it. Like, if this is what I do well, then maybe I just have to accept the fact that to do well, I have to be unhappy, as opposed to having the opportunity to experience a different version of yourself where you can be both at the same time, right? I can be happy and do well.
That, you know, you're so right about everything you just said. And you reminded me of a really important epiphany that I had when I, you know, when I made this transition and I started to write more and I started submitting my work to all various kinds of places and getting a lot of rejection, like a huge amount of rejection. And I felt horrible. I mean, like so horrible. And I realized I had this really big realization. It's like, I get it. All my professional life, I've succeeded. Like I've been well, I managed to get very well compensated. I won tons of awards and for all the things that I did, like I was like the gold star student at work, right? I always excelled. I always did well. And that was recognized despite my being unhappy, which is sort of this interesting paradox. But I realized that when I started writing full time, and especially in like fiction, it's an incredibly difficult craft. And you very few of us sort of just are born being phenomenal writers. You really have to learn it and practice it a lot. And I've suddenly realized, oh, I stepped out of my zone of expertise and experience and practice, and I stepped into this whole new arena where I did not have as much experience and practice, and I'm not doing very well at it. And so I have two options here. I can conclude, well, I'm terrible at this. I better stop. Maybe I should go back to what I know I'm good at. That's option A. But I say, no, don't do that. Because you're just going to recreate the wheel in an unhappy way. Option B is work at this thing that you want to be better at. I mean, we're never too old to try and learn, you know, and tackle something new and get better at it. And I have. Do I still get rejection? Oh, absolutely. But I've also gotten better. And so I realized that I wasn't used to failing at something I'd worked really hard at because I had been succeeding. And you have to be willing to live with that discomfort. That comes from doing anything new, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that what you said too about that temptation to just go back to the comfort zone, to go back to what you know and what you know you can do well, can be really strong in those moments of transition. It's just that voice that says, no, this is dangerous, right? Go back to the familiar. And so I want to talk a little bit about the self-doubt piece of what you're talking about, because I know that that's a big part of what you think about and what we sort of talked about offline is how do we navigate the self-doubt that's going to creep in these moments, especially, you know, like we're talking about it's sort of the devil, you know, kind of attitude of like, like, well, at least I know, at least this is predictable. At least I know that I can make a living at it, or at least I know what to expect. But can you say more about your experience with self-doubt or how you think about it?
Absolutely, because this is something I've been studying and writing about now for well over a year. Let me start with a distinction that I make between imposter syndrome and self-doubt. I view imposter syndrome as very real, no question. But imposter syndrome tends to arrive, I think, at its most acute when we have indeed gotten very good at something and we're recognized for that. But somehow inside, we don't feel we've earned the competence. We feel it maybe came easily to us, and we just feel that it's not earned, and we feel that people are overestimating us, which means we're just setting ourselves up for failure somewhere down the line, even though we keep on succeeding. So I feel imposter syndrome is this very particular thing that often arrives when, in fact, you've done really well. Self-doubt, is sort of the broadest sense, can be a very crippling set of messages or tapes that go on and on in our head that often prevent us from even making an attempt at this thing we might be good at down the line. It holds us back because it's the tapes that are playing that are saying, you know, you don't have this talent. You're not good enough at this. you know, you're not going to make it. You know, I don't think you should try this. You know, this is going to, you're going to fall flat on your face. You're not cut out for this. Don't do it. And so it's this sort of negative force that's holding us back from even trying. And what I always say is that you cannot expect to completely conquer and overcome self-doubt. I do think that it is built into the human condition. It also has protective qualities for us at times. I mean, if you're standing at the edge of a cliff and you're thinking, you know, I don't think I should jump. Well, you're right. You know, your doubts are keeping you nice and safe, right? But we can manage it. And there are many different ways of doing that. One of the things that it's important to do is sort of a common trick that I think is used a lot in various kinds of therapy, which is when those forces are coming up inside you in your head and saying, don't do it, don't take the risk, hold off, maybe later, and all those things are sort of coming loudly to the fore, what you need to do is acknowledge that what you're doing feels scary, but you're going to go ahead and do it anyway. And you're going to take that self-doubt and say, I see you, I feel you, I get it, I'm stepping into a risk. I might look foolish. I might do a bad job. I get it. But you know what? There's a potential upside here, and I'm going to try anyway, and let's see where it goes. Because more often than not, the upside is going to emerge when you push past the self-doubt. Rather than letting the self-doubt win the day, you need to kind of just forge on past. And, you know, let's respect the fear, right? I mean, fear can also be an ally, right? I mean, fight syndrome is also built into us for a reason, because it heightens our senses and enables us to really sort of respond in the moment. And so it's a good reason to sort of acknowledge those doubts, respect them, but force yourself to push on anyway, because you'll be so glad that you did.
Mm. And that really aligns with how I think about confidence building in general, is that confidence follows action, not the other way around, right? There's never going to come a day when we jump out of bed and say, I'm ready to do the scary thing I've been putting off, right? Like the confidence comes after you do the scary thing and you realize, oh, the world didn't collapse. Like, I lived to tell about it. And actually, there was a positive outcome, whatever that might be, right? Because I'm, you know, as someone with a lot of anxiety, my imagination is always far darker than reality. And so I think what you're saying is really important, of, you know, the self-doubt is going to be there. The goal is not to get rid of it. It's to understand it, and to move forward. Don't let it hold you back.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I can attest, and I'm very open about it. I mean, I have had some epic failures. I mean, I've had failures where it's so funny how badly I failed that you want to laugh. And you know what? I lived, and I've gone on to do all kinds of other things. I mean, just real, really quickly, I had to organize an event. I got a local celebrity in my neck of the woods to be the MC for this event, and every single thing that could go wrong went wrong. The performers were not properly rehearsed. The person who was supposed to be rehearsing them didn't do his job. It was a dark and stormy night, and no one could find the church we were holding the event, let alone the entrance. The word did not get out properly. It was not properly publicized, and nobody came. So there I was with this local celebrity who'd given me his evening for free to deliver this script, and there was nobody there. It was, I mean, literally like one person in this sea of chairs. And I could not have been more mortified. You know that feeling, you know, when you're having like the kind of dream where like you're suddenly like you're naked on stage, or you forgot you're on stage, you can't remember what to say. It was as I was living this, I actually was laughing to myself and saying, this is that nightmare in actual real life. I'm actually living that nightmare right here, right now. And I told myself in the moment, as mortified as I was, and believe me, I could not have been more mortified, this will pass. This is a thing. This is happening. It's one of the most horrible days of my professional life. But you know what? It's going to end, and I'll go on and do something else. So you have to teach yourself to be ready to fail and know that you can move on. It's just not the be-all and the end-all.
Yeah, that's such a powerful way of thinking about it. You reminded me too. I have two boys that are 8 and 13, and they're at that point where their social experience is becoming more and more important to their identities. And, you know, I just remember how uncomfortable middle school and high school and everything was. And I try to say that to them too, of like, feelings feel really strong in that moment, right? Like there, it feels like this is the biggest thing that's ever going to happen to you. But then you know, with time, you realize like, oh yeah, you can still look back on it and think, oh, that was horrible, but it doesn't define your life, right? And so I think that's a really good way for us to think about that as adults too, is we've lived to tell about every moment that didn't work well for us, right? It feels catastrophic at the time, but we keep moving on. And, you know, and I think we also learn from them, right? Like that is part of, when I think back on, you know, more recent moments where I'm like, oh, that just was horrible and I wish I had done it differently, I also feel like I got something valuable out of the experience too. I learned something that I now apply proactively.
Exactly.
You know?
That's so true. And, you know, one of the gifts we get in middle age is perspective. And so unlike the adolescent who cannot be expected, they haven't lived long enough to put things in that sort of perspective, and everything looms like the biggest thing ever, right? And that's understandable. That is that phase of you know, psychosocial development. But we have the gift of saying, oh, you know, this isn't going well, or this didn't go well, but you know what? As you say, I'm going to learn from this. I'm going to move on. And so one way of looking at self-doubt is that, things might go wrong. Yep, that voice of self-doubt might be right. But doesn't mean you shouldn't prepare and try, because as I said before, there's really is an upside in so many different ways. And it's better to try than not to try. It's better to test yourself in new ways than not to, because you grow in the end in ways that you will really appreciate.
Yeah. And I think about what you were saying too, and I keep coming back to how you described yourself as doing very well, but we're unhappy. And I think that what self-doubt and fear and a lot of these feelings and themes that we're talking about do is they keep us comfortable, but unhappy, right? And so we don't often think about, we're wired to think about, what do I lose by taking this step? We're not wired to think, what do I lose by not taking the step, right? And if you think about where you are today versus where you were, like, yeah, the safer choice would have been to stay where you were because it was predictable and familiar. But what that would have ensured is ongoing unhappiness, right? And so I think that's part of the analysis too, that we have to proactively insert, because it doesn't come naturally to us, is, yeah, but what's the risk of not doing this? What am I giving up by giving into the fear or the self-doubt?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's change doesn't come easily to many of us. We create, and we're in a culture, at least in the United States, we're in a culture where, you know, stability is sort of a prize thing, economic stability. Your days have a predictable course to them. You know what your obligations are, kind of day by day, you know who you're responsible for, and so we build this sort of predictability into our lives and routines, and we rely on that. And there's a lot about it that's both supporting and comforting, but there comes a time when it's worth breaking those routines and disrupting that to find a new kind of normal. And it can be uncomfortable when you're going through it. I mean, I was essentially a writer earning a really good six-figure salary. I never dreamed I would earn that much money given my skill set, which is basically, you know, writing, communications, all those things, journalism. And it took a lot for me to be able to say, you know what, this isn't worth it. I need to break out of this comfort, this routine, this cocoon. It's not worth it. I'm paying too high a price. And I think we talk about what the first step is. You have to have a really, really honest reckoning with yourself. Set aside for the moment the practical side of this. I have to be a breadwinner in my family, or I have to be a co-equal breadwinner. I have too many financial obligations. I can't possibly. You need to set that aside and interrogate your own psyche and say, I'm miserable and I deserve not to feel miserable. So how do I begin to think about changes and these off ramps where I don't feel so miserable? And as we said, it may be baby steps. But there are things you can almost always do to begin that process. And, you know, it's worth it because we deserve to pursue not happiness, not in a selfish sense, but in the sense of we deserve to pursue feeling fulfilled and that what we do matters. And that we're making the kind of difference we want to make, and that we're exploring sides of ourselves that have lain dormant, you know, all these years. When I started writing plays almost out of the blue, I don't know, dozen or so years ago, and I was thinking to myself, why am I writing play? Why did I gravitate to this? Why do I want to write plays? I was a theater goer like anybody else, but I wasn't rabid about it. And it took me months to remember that I'd been a theater kid. In middle school, I did drama all the time. I was in many, many plays. I was crazy about it. I thought I was going to go on to do it professionally. And I'd forgotten all about that. I buried all that passion under all those, you know, practical adult things. And then it sort of resurfaced through this back door. Why am I writing plays? Oh, I was a drama kid. I forgot.
That's a really important point, too, because you know, sometimes it might seem silly to look back at our childhood interests, but those are the purest versions of ourselves, right?
Yes. Before
the world started telling us no. And so to be thinking about what was it that you loved back when there were no boundaries or, you know, you had to worry about how much money you were going to make, et cetera, and really think about, are there aspects of yourself that you can express in new ways that link back to those interests?
Absolutely. And I think it's worth, you know, that's part of this process that we're going to go through in the beginning when it's just all in our head is trying to remember did you do things as a kid that you loved, you know, and what were they and what was it that you loved about it? You know, what was the feeling that it gave you and why? And you may not be able to duplicate that today, but you may be able to find some core truth about that feeling and find a way, you know, back into that.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think about when you were talking earlier too about we deserve to feel fulfilled and to mm-hmm. feel like we're making an impact. This is going to sound really cliche, but at the end of our lives, right? At the end of anyone's life, nobody says, I wish I'd stayed in my comfort zone.
Right. Or I wish I spent more time at the office, right?
As right, the cliche
exactly. goes, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you know, I certainly reached a point, you know, I think when I got into my 50s and I knew, you know, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's half over, right? And I knew, you know, this isn't, I'm not done being who I need to be. And I would say that I was a super, super, super late bloomer. Some people are, you know, they hit 22 and they know what they're destined to do for life and they do that and they're really happy. That's great. I'm not one of those people. I had to go through long sort of slog to figure out, you know what, this is not, I need to be over here doing these other things. You know, I need to step away.
Yeah. And even if you do know at 22, that might change at 40 or at 50,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And maybe, and I think that's part of it too, is that we sometimes, you talked about how our identities get wrapped up in what we do. And there's this sense of, I'm a failure. I'm not following through on these commitments, but maybe you got what you needed from that part of your life, right? Whatever stretch of time you invested in that education or that career. And now it's not that you're walking away because of failure. You're walking away because you've changed. Your values have changed. Your interests have changed.
So true. And finally, sort of having the courage to take action where action's needed. I thought about it for years before I did it. The other thing I'd note that is that all these experiences that we have leading up to, say, a pivot are additive, which is to say, a lot of what I do today and do pretty well today, I really did develop and practice skills in all those years when I was doing the things that maybe I was less happy with, but I was doing things that really helped me get skilled. And so, you know, being a journalist and being in communications and working with a lot of dense material and having to produce, you know, clear written stuff fast helps me today, you know, to write, say, a Substack newsletter more quickly and efficiently than maybe someone who doesn't have that kind of training, because I've just got that sort of those journalistic reflexes, you know? And so I'm grateful. I can't totally regret all the years I put in doing all those other things, because they helped me do the things I do today. Mm-hmm. But I did need to make a change, you know, and stop doing those things. But they did help.
And that's a good way to think about it, too, for anybody who's listening and thinking, oh, I'm not ready to even take what seems like a, you know, the next step, to just think about how can you do more of what interests you in the job you have today, right? Because there may be ways that you could have a conversation with your manager to say, hey, I really like to write and I'd like to find a way to do more of that in this current role or whatever it might be, right? Is incorporating it into the experience that you have now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it really does have to begin with, you have to know yourself, right? You've got to really be honest with yourself and learn what really is calling to you sort of on the inside that you may have been sort of neglecting or not even aware of. And you need to figure that out in order to do that for sure.
Yeah. And I think that when you talk about the reckoning with yourself, which I think is such a great idea, is there anything in particular that you would suggest people ask themselves or like, what would be an effective way in your mind for people who haven't even created the breathing room, as you described it, to have this conversation or this kind of reflection with themselves? Is there something you would use as a prompt?
Yeah, I think there's some really simple, basic exercises that you can do. They're tried and true. There's nothing magical about them except that they force you to focus in that moment, honestly. So there's a couple of ways of going about it. One is sort of a visioning exercise, which you can do a couple different ways. You can do it on paper, or you can do it really kind of by trying to take a meditative moment. And I don't mean like hardcore meditation, like breathing om and all that kind of thing. But I do mean literally sitting in a quiet space by yourself, not at work, with your eyes closed, and asking yourself, what have I been doing in the moments in my entire life where I really felt free and joyful? What was I doing? And give yourself time to try to remember. And so, for example, it might literally have been, wow, you know, when I was a kid, I was on the soccer team and I loved that feeling of running down the field. And it was amazing. And I felt so in control of my body and the ball. And so you can take a moment like that where you're remembering that joy and that sort of that passion and that just being sort of at one with the universe. Doesn't mean that you're going to suddenly become a pro soccer player at 48. But it may mean that you want to get back in touch with something that's really athletic, something that's competitive. Maybe you want to actually coach others to have that experience. You can begin to really interrogate what really sort of in your gut brought you those moments of joy. And I think that there's ways of doing that also on paper. You could literally do like a free writing exercise where you set a timer for 3 minutes and write down everything in your wildest dreams you always wanted to do and have never done. Just write them down. It's not a practical list. It's just a list. You want to travel around the world. You want to sail around. You want to learn how to sail. You want to meet all the things. And then begin to look at what's coming up. What patterns are coming up here? What kinds of experiences are these? And what are they saying to you? And how do I take a look at these and think about path to capturing some of that joy and passion and sense of freedom and sense of sort of self-control and sort of being at one with the world? How can I connect that in the life that I have? And this is what I mean about finding the pathways, because you're not going to just walk out on your family and say, I'm going to sail around the world because I can tell that that will make me really happy. So I'm not talking about that, right? I'm talking about doing this in a way that's practical, that gets you to this new place. Practically, because that's reality, right? We can't just all throw everything up and, you know, go do the dream.
That's exactly right. But this is a really great starting point. I really appreciate these suggestions, Amy. I think that they're really practical, as you suggested. And as we come to a close in our conversation, which has been fantastic, thank you so much. Where can people find you if they want more of you?
More of me. Easiest place to start, simply my author website, which is amywrites.live. It's AmyWrites, amywrites.live, live. There you can find My books, I would love people to join my mailing list, which is extremely easy to do. You will not be spammed. You won't hear from me endlessly. You will get a free literary gift when you do join my mailing list. And you'll learn about my book that's coming out this fall, which is apropos of this conversation. It's called Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration. And it really is meant to be a book of inspiration for every person who, you know, wants to be sort of creative and manage those self-doubts that are holding them back.
Oh, I can't wait. That's great. Thank you so much, Amy. All of the links will be in the show notes, and I just really appreciate having this conversation with you.
Thank you, Kim. It has been a pleasure and a wonderful conversation.
Thanks so much for listening to the Imposter Syndrome Files. If you would like to continue this conversation in a safe and trusted space, I would love for you to join my virtual discussion group every Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern. For the past several years, the group has been limited to women, but it is now open, regardless of gender, to anyone who is interested in exploring and troubleshooting common workplace challenges, building better awareness of ourselves and others, and becoming more inclusive allies at work. Check out the show notes for more info on how to find us, and please join us next week for another episode of the Imposter Syndrome Files.